Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We go through the same darn thing every time the government clues us in about inflation. They say it's not so bad if you take food and energy out. We say, have you been in a supermarket lately? Never mind filling up your gas tank. Jeez. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is May the 14th today. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. Inflation, we are told by the good people at the Commerce Department, was a completely tolerable 0.2% last month, a single tenth if you take out food and energy. But that core number hides the more troubling details. Food prices saw their biggest spike in 18 years last month. Energy? Well, we don't have to mention that with gas at a nationwide average of $3.72 a gallon now, do we? DuPont, in that vein, announced a new project today at the place that food and fuel overlap, a $140 million venture into the ethanol business, minus the corn. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
CEO Charles Holliday is calling it the largest opportunity he's seen in his 35-year career at DuPont.
We see at least a $75 billion market opportunity sometime in the next decade.
DuPont has partnered with Danish firm Danisco. Its goal is to produce commercially viable ethanol from old corn stalks and sugarcane waste within 3 years. It's called cellulosic ethanol because the energy comes from the woody stems of plants instead of valuable ears of corn. Holliday says that's what makes it so attractive in a time of surging food prices.
Clearly, when you're seeing corn at these prices that are multitudes higher than we've ever expected or seen in the past, if we can find a cellulosic way to meet the need, it's a win-win-win.
If DuPont pulls this off, it would be a first, and it could eventually drive a boom in non-food biofuel crops like switchgrass. But don't expect that to ease food prices. Ken Cook with the Environmental Working Group says even switchgrass has to grow somewhere.
It's really not so much about what is grown on the land, but the land that it's grown on.
Cook says as long as agricultural lands are being used for energy production instead of food, the two formerly separate economies will be closely linked. And he says with hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure for corn-based ethanol already in place, any meaningful shift away from that would take years. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
This item before we leave agriculture today. The House has passed the $290 billion farm bill. They passed it big, too, before they sent it on to the Senate. It boosts spending for biofuels and nutrition programs. But the president has already promised to veto subsidies are his big issue. In China today, rescuers reached some of the areas hardest hit by Monday's earthquake amid fears that the death toll could climb much higher than where it is right now, about 15,000. Offers of aid and supplies have been pouring in from around the world. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports Beijing has the luxury of picking and choosing.
China has turned down Japanese, South Korean, and Australian offers of rescue crews and sniffer dogs, although the Civil Affairs Ministry in Beijing says donations of cash and supplies are welcome. Not that they're needed.
China is probably better fiscally positioned than perhaps any other country in the world.
Donald Strassheim of Roth Capital Partners says they have a booming economy and $1.7 trillion in foreign reserves. But he says China's rulers are happy their trading partners are offering to help.
Rather than appearing as a sign of weakness, I think they regard it as indeed a sign of maturity, a sign that they are a full-fledged member of the global economic and financial community.
China knows it's under international scrutiny with the Summer Olympics just weeks away and with memories of the crackdown in Tibet still fresh. By some reports, the country is spending $120 million to respond to the earthquake. Michael Yehuda, a China scholar with the London School of Economics, says there's public relations opportunity in this natural disaster.
They feel that this will have, in some ways, improved their image after the very bad press they had. It will also improve the image of the West within China, because of the sympathetic way in which the West has responded.
Which may explain why China is allowing more news coverage of relief efforts than they have with past disasters. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks were up until they went down. Most people still wound up making money, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. International air travel is the most profitable part of the troubled global aviation industry. It's also probably the most heavily regulated, especially the routes between the U.S. and Europe. Negotiators from both sides of the Atlantic have been trying to hash out new rules for those routes. They'll meet tomorrow to talk about part two of what is called the Open Skies Agreement. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Open Skies Part 1 took effect last month. That allowed more American carriers to fly in and out of airports in Europe, including Heathrow. European carriers gained reciprocal rights in the US. That was the easy bit. Aviation analyst Howard Wealdon says now comes the much harder part.
What we want now is the opening up and allowing of European airlines to acquire large stakes and indeed the complete airlines themselves in the US and vice versa.
Under current rules, foreign companies can buy only 25% of an American carrier. That's unfair and anti-competitive, says Paul Charles of the British airline Virgin Atlantic.
Why is it that Ford of America, for example, is allowed to invest as much as it wants in the UK and open plants and invest in other car makers? But Virgin Atlantic as a carrier, for example, is not allowed to enter the US and own more than 25% of any particular American carrier.
He argues the global airline industry has been hopelessly fragmented by these archaic ownership rules. It must consolidate to cut costs, especially with oil at $125 a barrel. And, he says, European carriers should be allowed to operate freely within the US.
The principle here is about freedom of choice and freedom for carriers to be able to fly from any city to any city.
But consolidation and increased competition could mean big job losses in the US and Europe. Tomorrow's meeting in Slovenia is unlikely to lead to a breakthrough in this US election year. Joe Lample is with the Cass Business School in London.
No American politician would in any way do anything that would jeopardize employment or autonomy of American business interests. So this will have to wait till next year.
But not much longer than that. If the US fails to offer equal traffic rights and open up its ownership rules, by 2010 it could lose the airport access it gained in Europe last month. Part one of the Open Skies deal could be rescinded. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you swing by the store tonight on the way home and plunk down $10 or $15 for a bottle of wine to have with dinner, you can be reasonably sure that whatever's inside is what the label says it is. But the risk of getting some fraud along with your wine rises with the price tag. So imagine the dastardly possibilities with a single bottle that sold for $156,000, a 1787 Chateau Lafite that may or may not have belonged to Thomas Jefferson. Ben Wallace tells the story in his new book, The Billionaire's Vinegar. I asked him to put that auction price into context for us.
Well, it's the most expensive single bottle of wine that has ever sold. Before this bottle sold, the most expensive bottle that had sold had cost $38,000. And before that, one had gone for $31,000. Since then, there have been a few records that seem to beat it, but they were bottles that perhaps were six times as large. You know, these bottles that are called Jeroboams or magnums of wine, and that's a very different thing.
What does that wine auction audience think about when it's bidding on a rare or premium wine?
Well, in the case of that particular Jefferson bottle, it was a freak. It was not just a really old wine, although it was that, and it was not just a Chateau Lafite, which is one of the greatest wines of France. It had Thomas Jefferson's initials supposedly inscribed in it. So that really set this bottle apart from almost all other wines, because most other wines are commodities. I mean, maybe 100,000 bottles, even of a really great wine, might be produced in 1 year. there are certain vintages, 1961, 1945, 1928, that are these cult vintages that people will pay a premium for. And there are certain chateaux, Lafitte, Margaux, Mouton, Petrus. And when you get the combination of a, you know, Mouton 1945, people go bananas, and there's no telling how much they'll pay.
These wines, to get it back to the Jefferson bottles, it turns out it was a fraud perpetrated on the global wine industry by one guy, right? This Hardy Rodenstock, a German wine entrepreneur. How did he do this?
The auction market is very secretive, probably by necessity. I mean, no one knows who the last owner of a bottle of wine was. And so it's pretty easy if one person can convince a really powerful gatekeeper, such as the head wine auctioneer from Christie's, Michael Broadbent. If you can get it past him, then he vouches for it, and then the wine is good as gold.
And how did we begin to discover that these bottles weren't what we all thought they were?
From the very beginning, there were questions. Monticello, very early on, and even before the original record-setting auction, had discovered that the vintages and chateau of these Jefferson bottles did not tally with the historical record. Jefferson left an incredibly meticulous and thorough record of all of his wine purchases, and they just didn't match up. And Rodenstock has never really provided a satisfying answer for where he got the bottles, even when he was coming under suspicion.
One thing I'm not even sure about, having come to the end of this book, it was the bottle itself fake? Was the wine fake? Was it a combination of the two? I mean, what exactly was the fake part of this?
The fake part was the whole story. Did it belong to Jefferson? Almost certainly not. Was the engraving of the initials THJ, was that because it had belonged to Jefferson? No, because apparently it was done with a modern power tool. Is the bottle itself fake? Probably not. It seems to be an authentically old bottle. And as for the wine inside, that particular bottle has not had its wine tested, so who knows? But it's almost certain that the wine inside is not legit either.
Kind of sad, huh?
It is. I was really hoping that they would turn out to be real. When I began working on the book, I hoped that they would be real, and it was such a neat idea to think that Thomas Jefferson's wine might have survived 200 years entombed, you know, in this hidden cellar in the middle of Paris, and then to think that perhaps it was just cooked up in some guy's basement in Munich is a little disappointing.
The book by Ben Wallace is called The Billionaire's Vinegar. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
If you want to find out how the story ends and how the wine world got hoodwinked, we've got the rest of my chat with Ben Wallace online. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, filming a new vision of Africa.
The Western media has had a perpetual propaganda against Africa. What they tell the world about Africa is poverty, is sickness, diseases. So through the Nigerian films, we tell our stories.
But first, let's do the numbers. That better-than-expected inflation data we told you about gave spirits a lift on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials ended up a half of 1%, 66 points, closed at 12,898. The Nasdaq traded flat to slightly higher, closing up a point at 2496. The S&P 500 finished up 0.4%, 5 points, 1408 is the number there. Freddie Mac jumped 9% today after it reported earnings. The mortgage funding company racked up a $151 million loss, but Wall Street was expecting worse. Deere and Company released good numbers, but saw its stock fall nearly 10%. The tractor maker said rising raw materials costs and part shortages could make it a rough year this year. Yields on 10-year Treasury stayed pretty much put at 3.91%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. NASA gives an update on its Constellation program. One of the aims is to put a human back on the moon by 2020. Members of the National Women's Cycling Team gear up to address a congressional bike caucus on cycling issues and women's health. And for those already looking forward to their vacations, AAA releases its annual Memorial Day weekend travel forecast. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. For all the buzz out there that the economy might be able to skate by without going into recession, we've got just one word for you today: foreclosure. RealtyTrack reports the number of foreclosure notices rose 65% in April over the same time a year ago. And the gloomy housing market's not sparing anybody. The New York Post said this week more than 100 homeowners in East Hampton and Southampton, where upper-crust New Yorkers go to get away from it all, they've gotten nasty letters from their banks, too. Commentator David Frum says trouble in the Hamptons underscores the hazards of an asset bubble.
A sudden upsurge of home foreclosures in the Hamptons, the posh playground of the ultra-rich. The New York Post took malicious pleasure in the story, identifying defaultees by name and giving their street and town for good measure. Tough town, New York. But this is more than just a kick-em-when-they're-down story. The mortgage crisis is not only a crisis of the small borrower. Big borrowers also made use of adjustable-rate mortgages, interest-deferred mortgages, convertible mortgages, and all the other instruments that enabled Americans in the double zeros to buy more house with less money. In one way, big borrowers were even more vulnerable than small. They paid higher interest rates. Until March of this year, the federal mortgage insurance corporations did not cover loans bigger than $417,000. Jumbo loans could cost substantially more. And in today's panicky market, the rate on a jumbo loan has at times spiked as much as a point and a quarter higher than a smaller loan. Result? In California, only about 15.5% of homes sold in February 2008 were financed with jumbo loans, down from almost 40% in February 2007. These conditions have triggered an accelerating decline at the top of the home market. And that decline, in turn, could, stress could, severely weaken the balance sheets of upper as well as lower income households. The economic expansion of the 2000s concentrated its benefits on upper income Americans. Median incomes at the expansion's end had only just caught up to where they stood in the year 2000. This was an asset boom, not an income boom. And now the value of the most important category of assets is dropping. Could make for choppy times ahead. For if the fun of the boom was enjoyed by only a few, the pain of the bust may soon be shared by all.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Your thoughts can come back to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. The global economy isn't all about huge conglomerates and multinational corporations. At its core, it's about a single person doing a job trying to get by. Today on our series, Working, where we explore the lives of individuals in that global economy, we turn to the arts. The world's most prestigious film festival starts today in Cannes in southern France. Entries from 20 different countries are competing for the big prize, the Palme d'Or, the Golden Palm. Conspicuously absent, though, is anything from the third largest movie producer in the world. That'd be Nigeria. The film industry in Nollywood, which is what they really call it, cranks out more than 1,000 movies a year. Sure, most of them do go straight to DVD, but they are hugely popular in Africa and increasingly in the U.S. and Europe. John Miller tells us that to be a Nollywood director, you've got to be an artist and an entrepreneur.
For Lancelot Odua Imaswen, it has been one of those days. He's in the basement of a hotel in Lagos in a hot little utility closet with about 20 people doing take after take after take, and it is not coming out right. The movie's called Let's Dance Again, sort of a Nigerian flash dance. In this scene, a woman from a rival dance group comes into our hero's dressing room just before the big contest and tries to psych him out.
I've searched all the dressing rooms.
But she's just not convincing, and Lancelot knows it.
You want to be sarcastic?
Powerfully built in shorts and a t-shirt, he steps out from behind the camera.
The dynamite! The dynamite!
Lancelot's one of Nigeria's best-known filmmakers. He started out on stage, though, and deep down, he's still an actor. Unfortunately, most of the people in this movie aren't, and you can tell it's driving him nuts. Lancelot's been pushing to make Nollywood more professional. In the middle of yet another take, it occurs to him to ask whether anyone here is a member of the Actors Guild.
How many?
Turns out only one person is.
Is that true?
And that's a problem. He summons the casting director.
Are you aware that there's nobody here that is a guild member outside Portia?
And Portia's only here because she won a contest on TV.
It's a very, 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 very serious matter, and I will be in trouble.
According to his contract, everyone in this movie is supposed to join the guild. Lancelot Imaswen has directed more than 150 movies, about one a month for the last 13 years, and every single one of them has been a struggle. Low budgets, lousy equipment, constant power cuts, all for about $10,000 a film. You can pretty much forget about royalties. With so much piracy, there's no way to track the sales. But on balance, Lancelot says, things are kind of awesome.
We're so happy, we're so excited that now we have something to show the world. Our people are talented, our people are creative. They are making something out of nothing. I've personally been to about 31 countries in the world. As a result of being a practitioner in Nollywood, wherever I'm introduced, they know me, they know my works. Africans, wherever they are traveling to, wherever they are in the world, they must go with copies of the film. That is their link home.
So we're in a housing project where it's supposed to shoot today, and some of the talent has not shown up. It's been a couple of hours just sitting around, and then Lancelot just got a telephone call from one of the financiers, which upset Lancelot quite a bit, which is putting it somewhat mildly. He's been on the cell phone ever since.
What's going on? What's happening?
Part of production, always, everywhere in the world. We're just re-strategizing.
While Lancelot re-strategizes, I wander over to talk to Desmond Elliott, the romantic lead in this movie. He's suddenly become an international movie star, and he is loving it.
Washington is crazy, because we have concentration of Africans. Houston is another, New York, Brooklyn, Queens, Baltimore. Africa, I can't even walk around the streets in Africa. It's crazy. I am like the Denzel of Africa. You know what I mean?
Lancelot has told me he'd like to be Africa's Richard Attenborough, a great actor who went on to direct historical epics like Gandhi and A Bridge Too Far. He'd also like to win an Oscar. If he does, he says it'll probably be for a movie in his native language, Edo, and not for a mass-market Nollywood video. But first, he's got to finish this one, and it seems like nobody, not the backers, the actors, the crew, is nearly as invested as he is.
It can be very frustrating. They don't even know why they are there. They have other things on their minds. So you need to scream and scream and scream and scream.
The next day, Lancelot's in Desmond Elliott's Dodge Durango, heading up a little convoy, looking for a place to shoot. Nollywood doesn't do sets. Everything's shot on location. Finally, we stop at a car wash on a busy street in Lagos. The camera crew and actors jump out of their vehicles, and Lancelot and company take the place over. It's a scene where the dancers wash cars to raise money for costumes. Lancelot is kinetic. In long shorts and a blue basketball jersey, he dances with the actors, follows the cameraman into the street, shouts at passing traffic. It's work, but he is clearly having a blast. This is actually a pretty posh production with a budget of around $60,000. That's about three times what most movies here cost. Like almost all Nollywood films, melodramas, gangster movies, monster movies, this one at root is a morality tale. In Nollywood, hard work pays off, and the bad guys never win. That's a point Lancelot makes over and over when he talks to Westerners.
Because the Western media has had a perpetual propaganda against Africa. What they tell the world about Africa is poverty, is sickness, diseases. So through the Nigerian films, we tell our stories by ourselves, for ourselves. And our people have come to fall in love with this.
The climax of Let's Dance Again takes place back in the hotel where we started. The scene was actually shot on my first day in Lagos. The airline had lost my luggage. I wasn't wearing socks, and I had a big black stain on my shirt. Not exactly the way I would have planned my Nollywood debut, but Lancelot insisted.
Where are the judges? Where are the writing materials?
So it looks like I've been pressed into service as a judge in the great dance contest. I sit at a little table next to the stage, and through multiple takes and one amusingly timed power failure, I try to look judgmental.
Judges, I hope we are ready with the results.
Lancelot Imaswen says this movie is a good metaphor for Nollywood. That's why he was attracted to it in the first place. It's about a group of people, all down on their luck, who come together to compete for fame and glory. They confront their demons, dig deep within themselves, and ultimately...
Who do you think will win?
Well, I don't want to wreck the ending.
John Miller went to Lagos, Nigeria to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. You can see pictures of Lancelot Imaswen in action on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes, Barack Obama went 3 for 3 today with former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He picked up endorsements from William Donaldson, Arthur Levitt, and David Reuter. They were given their jobs by Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Reagan in that order. The Obama campaign also says John Edwards is going to support the senator from Illinois. And to follow up on our final from yesterday that Carl Icahn might be making a play for Yahoo, there is word today that he is. Reuters is reporting Icahn is going to launch his proxy fight tonight to get control of Yahoo's board and then force CEO Jerry Yang back into negotiations with Microsoft. The clock is forcing me to say this, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow added 66 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq traded pretty much flat. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.4%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, it's not quite Indiana Jones, but it's close.
They excavate in Egypt. They restore in Egypt. They take photographs. They do things. We'll tell them no. If you don't cooperate with us, we will not cooperate with you.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.